Hey everybody, and welcome to a very special episode of the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and I know this is a different, not an ideal studio environment. We're inside our RV in the middle of the desert, but with me here is our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And we have a special guest with us, a friend of the podcast, Trainer Road user, an incredible athlete, 24-hour world champion, Sonia Looney. How you doing?
Good. Hi, everyone.
And for those that don't know, you should check out Sonia has a podcast too, actually. Yeah,
what's it called?
It's called The Sonia Looney Show, and it's about mindset, plant-based nutrition, and inspiring stories to help you be better every day.
Nice.
That's a good pitch.
Yeah. Got the tone right, too. It was good. So, and you've been racing mountain bikes for some time. You started out racing a lot of XCO stuff. You ended up transitioning more into the endurance side of things, ultra endurance as well. In fact, like, usually merit or mountain biking, for those that don't know, usually it's broken down. So there's like short track, which is really rare. Short track is like a 30-minute event, but that would be a long one, usually like 15 to 20 minutes usually. And then from short track, you go to XCO, or cross-country Olympic. That's usually somewhere around 90 minutes, give or take 15 to 30 minutes on either side. Then you go into marathon. That's usually like 30 to 50 miles-ish. We're talking somewhere around like a three-hour race. And then there's ultra marathon, which that's like 100 miles, who knows how long. And then you also have done like crazy stage races across Mongolia and Brazil. I mean, all over the place too. So this podcast is going to be really focused on takeaways from endurance, ultra endurance racing, that sort of stuff, because we are actually here. Nate, do you want to tell them where we are and what we're doing?
We're in the 24 hours at Old Pueblo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by Epic Rides. It's a sweet event. It's kind of like Burning Man meets a 24-hour bike race. So Nate, Pete, Brandon, one of our product managers, you've seen him on the podcast before, and myself, we're on a team of four, but you can do it solo, you can do it as a team of two, like you, and who's your teammate, Sonia?
My teammate is Gordon Wadsworth, aka Quadsworth.
Yes, you can find him on Instagram at Quadsworth, right? And then you can also do it as a team of, you can just do it solo, duo, you can do it anything. I think beyond four, it's just like a, I think it's almost like a free-for-all.
No, there's like a five-person team, right?
Five-person.
And then what does it do?
And then it goes corporate. So that means you can just do like one lap and then drink beer the rest of the time.
Got
Maybe
it.
One day I'll be on a corporate team.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like we're not as smart. We should have done corporate
team, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll talk about kind of specifically, we'll probably keep referring to this race, right? Because that's where we're at. But we'll talk about specific things that we do to get faster in these contexts. So I guess first thing we should probably talk about, you won your world championship, 24-hour world championship in 2015, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And in California. Mm-hmm. What, I guess, was that, you mentioned this earlier, so I'm kind of setting this up, but it wasn't like you were a super experienced endurance racer coming into that, right? Like really ultra endurance sort of stuff.
Like I had done lots of 100 milers and stage races, but I had done, like I had won lots of nationals for 24-hour racing, but it'd be like as a two-person team or as a four-person team. And I had only done one other race where I had to ride my bike all night, and that was this underground race in Colorado called the Vapor Trail. So really, I had never done a solo race, but I really wanted to check off a 24-hour solo race, and I saw that there was a world championship that I could drive to, 20-hour drive, but still drivable.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I'll go give it a try and see what happens.
So your first 24-hour race, you won the world championship in the elite field?
Yeah, and it was pretty interesting because
yeah.
Unfortunately, you know, there was people in the sport who were like big time veterans in 24-hour solo racing. So I like Nat Ross and Rebecca Rush, I just called them up and said, "Hey, do you have any advice for me?" And the main advice that they gave was to stop eating the sugary foods after a certain point. So
what point?
For me, it was the 8-hour mark, because I know that I can do a 100-mile mountain bike race on almost solely gels. So I knew that I would be able to handle it. But after that, I started switching to solid food.
So what solid food did you eat after 8 hours?
Pop-Tarts, gummy bears.
Those,
nice.
Those are sugary.
Sugary, but it's not as concentrated.
Uh-huh.
I'd say that my go-tos were almond butter sandwiches and miso soup.
Ooh, almond butter sandwiches.
Would you put anything else in the almond butter? Like jelly or just like bread and...
Yeah, jelly or some honey.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So it's still pretty carb-centric, but you're adding in fats and a little bit of protein.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help you with your stomach?
I think so. I mean, I've never had any issues with gels and my stomach. I'm one of those like hard, I guess I have a hardened digestive system, but right. I wasn't about to test it out for the first time at a 24-hour race.
You mentioned that earlier. So we are famously great at trying brand new things on race day, which when I say famously great, I mean, we screw up a lot with this repeatedly. Yeah. But you mentioned even the fact that for this race, you said, So you're sponsored by Maxxis, right? So which tires are you running for 24 hours in the Old Pueblo?
For this race, and this is also my setup at home, which I really enjoy, I run the Ardent Race 2.35 up front and the Icon 2.35 in the rear.
And that Icon 2.35 is pretty big volume. I feel like for 2.35 even, it's pretty big. So, mm-hmm. And you're running that here, right? And you mentioned, like, it was funny, you mentioned, like, it's just what I know, and I haven't tried the other options for in this sort of environment, so that's what I want to stick with. That's super smart. Like, meanwhile, I'm
smarter than us.
I'm thinking of all the things that I can just throw at the wall and see if they stick.
Three quarters of our team are riding on tires we've never ridden before.
Yeah.
There could be benefit to that, too, though. Like, you probably don't need as much bang for your buck as I'm riding. Like, these are the tires I use in BC.
Yeah.
But coming into the race, I didn't have the opportunity to ride. I mean, I've only ridden outside once since basically mid-December, so I didn't want to take a risk of like not being on my bike for a long time and then trying a new tire, because there's been times where I have put 2.2s on and it rides different and I'll find myself sliding everywhere because I'm used to the bigger footprint.
Yeah, so riding in BC, that's a technical place, right?
British Columbia, for those that don't know. Yep.
Very technical place. Different dirt than here. How do you decide when you go to travel, like what tire? Because you can't pre-ride here, right?
Like pre-ride Mongolia.
Yeah, but probably can't in your area. I don't know, maybe you can, but the dirt's different. How do you make that decision?
I pretty much just use the same tires, to be totally honest. I mean, there are the odd times where I will run a different tire, and that comes from asking people who have done the event before or just stuff that I've read about it. But typically, I just run the same tires everywhere, which, you know, is controversial for some people. If I know it's going to be really wet or muddy, I might change it up. But I think it's better to ride what you're used to riding.
Mm, yeah, that's a really good point, because even if the mud tire is going to be better for muddy conditions, you may not know how that mud tire rides. And that's something that I feel like a lot of people misunderstand. It's not like you'll be able to change your tire for the circumstances and everything will work perfectly. Like, you have to learn how to ride with that specific tire.
I want to know something. So your first 24-hour mountain bike race, you win the world championship. What did that feel like?
Yeah, it had to have been crazy.
And two, at a part of the course, you knew you were going to win, right?
Well, you can't really just make assumptions because anything can happen. But the interesting thing was the start was so fast and I wasn't expecting that. And there was a lot of fast women at this race. Like, it wasn't a race without female competition. So there was women I just watched ride away from me on the first climb. And I had to tell myself, like, I know I can't hold that pace for 24 hours and I'm going to try and ride the most steady race I possibly can. And after a few laps, I took the lead, and throughout the night is where I really got ahead. Like, I would only be ahead by a couple of minutes for hours and hours and hours, but really it's the consistency that matters the most. Mm. And I made lots of mistakes as well, and if I were to do it again, there's, especially with like battery life and things like that, I could have been more prepared.
Right.
And also, I only had my husband in the pit. There's just one person, which most people had 2 to 3 people, because the support person is a true part of your team, and without the support person or people, there's just no way that you could be successful.
Yeah, so there were a number of key things that I'd like to run through there. First of all, you said battery issues. Are you talking about lights? Are you talking about your head unit? Are you talking like what? And head unit, I mean bike computer. Like, what things did you realize with batteries?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, the lights on your helmet and the lights on your handlebar. So there's like different battery sizes that you have, like 6 cell, 3 cell, 2 cell, and then they have a certain battery life at high, medium, and low. Mm. So the anticipation of how long the battery is going to last is something where you wouldn't have to stop as many times. I probably changed the batteries more than I needed to because I was paranoid about them running out.
Got it. So that was probably excess stress on probably a very stressed mind and body going through a 24-hour race that you didn't need. What do you use now in terms of your light setup? You mentioned one on the helmet, one on the bike. I've used that setup too. Why do you prefer that, and like, which lights do you use?
I'm using the Light in Motion. I have a Stella on the helmet, which is an 800 lumen light, and then I have a Seca on the handlebar, which is a 2000 lumen.
That's your setup.
Online it says you can use the Seca on the helmet as well. It's like, so that'd be 2000 lumens on both, which I think might be a bit overkill.
You might set bushes on fire.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you have them set up on your helmet, do you change the intensity of the light? I've heard of a lot of people doing that. Like, they'll run one higher than the other to help with depth perception. So for example, like, your bars will be low, but your head will be higher, that sort of a thing. Or have you found, do you drop the power when you go slow and pick it up when you go fast? What do you do?
On dirt road type stuff, you drop it. The helmet, the 800 lumens, it's going to blow through battery a lot slower because it's not as bright. So you can run that one on high. So I typically run the helmet on high, and then the handlebar one I modulate more to medium.
What about if, because you're going to do tomorrow a two-person team, would you just run them the whole time and then try to charge between laps, or you'd still that same strategy?
I have an extra set of batteries, so I'll probably be running mostly on high, and then while I'm out, be charging the other set. So before I came here, I actually ran the batteries out while I was actually on the trainer to see how long that they would last.
Yeah. So that's a good idea, to run through and make sure you know how long it lasts.
How long do they last?
I don't know off the top of my head. I think it might have been like 2.5 hours or something like that.
Plenty of time. Yeah. That's how most lights are, Jonathan?
Yeah, I find that like with my lights, they don't even make the lights I use anymore. So it's probably not worth saying, but they're called jet lights. But I think that it's like 1 hour on high, like really high, and then it has a medium setting, and that's 3 hours. And then I've actually ran it for, I think, 3.5 hours on low, and it was still going just fine. So I don't know how far into it,
The good takeaway is to test it at home, but I think most lights probably for an hour lapse or hour 10 laps, you're going to be just fine.
Yeah.
To not have to worry.
What about, so looking back at the 24-hour, the experience you had with that, then how you basically implement now based off of that, what about, you mentioned a consistent pacing strategy. This is mountain biking. It's not like it's RAM, like Race Across America, where you can have like really consistent pitches. How do you manage the steep parts? Because that's like a big, out here, I think there's a lot of opportunity, at least on this course, for people to, and I'm sure where you were at in California, for people to kind of gun it every time it kicks up and get over that little pitch a little easier. Do you cut those out, and do you just try to like modulate the effort, let the speed be the speed? Or how do you work through that?
Yeah, well, you know that feeling of, oh, this is a little bit harder now, or, oh, this kind of hurts, like on our pre-ride today. Mm-hmm. It kind of hurt a little bit more on the climbs because we were going a little bit quicker.
Sorry.
Yeah, Jonathan. Someone's fault.
Jerk.
So, yeah, in a really long race, whether it be a 100-mile race, whether it be just if you're on a really long ride with your friends, if you want to last, try not to accelerate. Try to actually, I put it in an easier gear. I intentionally shift to an easier gear and just try and say, just ride a little bit easier, and it's going to be worth it.
Yeah, that's super hard to do with mountain biking, right? Because you feel every little pitch and you just want to jam up it to get past.
You said you made some mistakes for your first time that you would change. Besides the lights, what any other mistakes that you made that you would not have made or don't want to make anymore?
I think having a second person in the pit, because it's really hard on that person because you're coming through every hour to hour and 15. So for them, it'd be nice for them to have a break.
Yeah, we'll talk about our team, which is very, very possible that it's a very bad idea, whatever we're doing. But so we brought somebody as a Swanee for our setup, but we weren't planning on having that person down in the exchange area. So like, I guess in your case, it was 24-hour solo, but this year you're racing as a team with one other teammate, which is basically solo because you're constantly, you know, switching off every hour, in this case, roughly an hour. Would you have a person in the pit area over there? Or do you think that it's better to have a person back taking care of teammates wherever you're camping? What would you say? Like in our situation, what would you do?
I would recommend having them at camp and maybe having the Swanier pay attention to what lap times are and setting an alarm. That way the person knows that they have 20 minutes to get ready or however long they think they might need.
Okay, yeah, that's a good idea. And I think that we can follow timing live on this one. I'm not sure. I'm not sure if you know either, Sonia. But that could be extra helpful. But likely, we're probably looking at somewhere around an hour and 10 minutes for lap times for us. Lower than that, right, Nate? Nice.
That's right.
Okay, nice. Do you know what our lap time was today? I haven't looked at it quite yet.
No, but I think 115, about 115, and we're riding. We stopped to go to the bathroom and
pretty
stuff.
Easily. Yeah. Okay, cool. So another thing that I think is like little details as far as on team setup, how do you coordinate with your teammate? In most cases, it seems like a lot of these people are kind of meeting up here, like they're friends from different places, but they kind of come here together. Are there any, like, what are the conversations like that you have with your teammate? What are the check boxes that you're trying to run through with your teammate before you show up at a 24-hour race?
I think number one, making sure that you have the same goal, because a lot of people come to 24-hour races for fun. Like they don't really care about winning or for performance. They just want to come have fun with their buddies.
Yeah.
So number one, like making sure everyone on the team is on the same page. And then, I think that's pretty much it. Like just talking about your goals and making sure they're in line.
Yeah.
That's huge, because before this, like it's if you have one person that's not in it, to go hard, if everyone's going hard, it kind of ruins the experience, but also the other way around.
Yeah.
If everyone else wants to be chill and one person's like the crazy one who wants everyone to go fast, the chill level is just gone.
Right. Having that balance across would be good to have. What do you do to recover between these sort of efforts? I guess first we should probably talk about the equipment. How many kits do you bring? So chances are in this case, you might do like 12, you might even do like 12 laps, 10 to 12 laps, I guess. How many kits do you bring? Do you change those out? How'd you manage all that?
The answer is I don't really know. I brought 7 kits because I have 7 kits.
Yeah.
And probably during the day, I might skip a few laps of changing the kit. But at night, 100%, I'll be changing the kit because you get sweaty out there on the lap and then you come in and it's freezing and it's really uncomfortable. So being able to get dry and get warm is so important, especially at night.
So when you finish a lap, let's say for the 2-person race, what's your, like, you just finish, what are the steps that you go through?
Yeah, like right off the bike, right, what are the things that you want to do?
So disclaimer is the last duo I did was, I don't even know how long it's been. It was a national championship, though, which was awesome. So my plan is to come in off the lap, immediately change, eat something that's, but not a lot, eat a little something of some of the foods I mentioned before. I'm going to use my same nutrition strategy as I did in 24 solo. And then sit down and try not to fall asleep.
But I mean, do you get out of your kit right away?
Yeah, get out of the kit immediately.
Immediately.
And that's to get out of the sweaty kit so then you don't get chilled, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's probably, I mean, a comfort thing too. Like when you take your kit off, you feel like you can actually relax.
You have, like, your partner's a fast dude, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to be, by the time you get there, you can only have like 45 minutes maybe, right?
Yeah, until you have to get ready again.
I'll probably just put a fresh kit on, like take off the wet kit, put a fresh kit on, and then put tons of warm clothes on top of it. And then we also have an elevated legs set, so maybe do the elevated legs for like 10 minutes or 20 minutes or however long.
That's a smart thing to do.
Do you use caffeine?
Definitely. Yeah, I don't have any like systematized way of using caffeine, but I probably won't be drinking coffee the entire time because that can be hard on your digestive system. But basically, when you need it at night, drink the caffeine.
What about like hydration? Like, how are you? I want to go through both the on the bike, because it sounds you only have so much time to eat like off the bike, so you're gonna have to do a lot on the bike too, right?
Yeah.
And then what happens like hydration wise?
And this course in particular is there's not a lot of spots to eat because it's twisty single track.
There's cactus everywhere.
Yeah.
If you take that bottle, when you're focusing on taking a bottle out, a small little bobble could be really bad.
You guys didn't see, but it almost happened to me.
Yeah, it can happen. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to be trading off every other lap. So I use Goo Roctane products. So for one lap, I'll do a bottle with Goo Roctane. The next lap, I'll do water. And that's exactly what I do in 100-mile races as well.
Okay, yeah, so that's stuff that you can process quickly, easy to eat as well. It's not like it's something where you're trying to work it out of a package that'll be really complex. The nice part, like the goo packets are smaller, right, in the sense, so then you aren't spending a long time squeezing a bunch of.
But you're doing the drink, right? Or is it the, is Roctane a drink and a gel?
Yeah, it can be.
Are you doing the gel then or the drink?
I'll have both. So the reason why I trade off is to make sure that I'm getting enough water. And I'm actually not going to be carrying any gel packets. I use Goo flasks, and this is how I do all of my races. And it's
smart.
It's a really helpful tip because a lot of times, especially as a mountain biker, you don't want to be messing with the goo packet. You don't want to be dropping any garbage. And the trick that I do is I add water into the flask so that you can digest it a little bit easier, because a lot of times people take in too much sugar and not enough water.
Yeah, and then it makes it easier to get out of the flask too, I assume.
Another tip I think is if you have a really tight skin suit, I have one skin suit without pockets, you put it in your
chest area.
Yeah, in your chest area, because it's a lot easier to get out, especially with twisty stuff, to grab that quickly than to reach around.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, you could kind of like stash it by your collarbone almost right up there if it's not too uncomfortable. Huh. That's a good one to think of. What about, so that's the off the bike, are you going to be taking, like you said, that sort of like almond butter and like honey sandwich, that sort of stuff?
Yeah, and I bought white bread today, which is a weird thing, but you want low fiber foods, because if you're eating a lot of high fiber, then it's going to bring a lot of blood into your gut, which we don't want.
Yeah, exactly.
What about hydration? Do you like try to get a certain amount of water? Do you take a recovery drink, electrolytes when you're off the bike?
I'm not a big recovery drink fan at the moment. Like, I just haven't really found one that I like. So I just eat food immediately whenever I finish. And then I'll try to be like sipping on water or even the tabs that you can use, the electrolyte tabs, because those don't have sugar in them. So you can just drink that.
That makes sense.
What's your, can we go over your power and your weight? Because I think it's really interesting. We don't get a lot of numbers from elite women athletes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I weigh between, it depends on the day, but 132 to 133 pounds, and that's the sweet spot for my body.
That's very specific.
I have been as light as 127 to 128, and that was for a while kind of my body set point. So for whatever reason, it's sitting at 132 to 133. And my power is about 270 for my FTP. That's what I have it set in Trainer Road.
I guess the other part of this, though, that's interesting to talk about for, I guess, pacing with that. Do you use your power meter at all when you're pacing through these sort of efforts? Or is this sort of a thing where, like are you looking at it to govern your effort when you're riding? Or just afterward, it's nice to have the data?
Well, currently, I don't have a power meter on my bike. But when I do, I actually really do like using it, especially at the starts of races, because a lot of times we're excited, the adrenaline is high, our heart rate's like 130 just standing there.
Yeah.
So having that data can really help you be smarter about your pacing.
And kind of like emulate, I guess, the situation that you had with that one race where you took your time, like instead of just jamming up the hills right in the beginning of 24-hour worlds, you know, you could take your time with that. Is there anything special that you do for your bike for like these longer endurance style races compared to, for example, like if you were to do like a short race, like an Olympic race or a cross country Olympic race, something like that, like in terms of setup, whether it's suspension or things you might tape to your bike or carry with you, is there anything different there?
Yeah, for really long races, a lot of times you have to carry more food for one, and you typically want to have stuff just in case because the attrition thing becomes a big part of the racing. So I'll tape a tube to my bike. I'll have one of those little like spiky plug things.
Yeah.
You know,
those are tire plugs.
Yeah. Tire plugs. Mm-hmm. I'll carry extra food. I'll have extra CO2s. And one thing that I always have with me is a hand pump, because I've had CO2s fail before. And if that fails and that's all you have, or you have, fortunately I have never had this problem, but if you have enough flat tires where you run out of CO2s, then what are you going to do?
Yeah. How do you manage, I guess, the lead up to a race like this? Today we did a pre-ride where we rode the loop. You don't always get to do that. But how do you manage yourself like the day before the race? Are you the type of person that really likes to take it very easy before a race? So is this bad today?
It's a hard lap with Jonathan and then a podcast late into the night.
Yeah. Or do you like, in your ideal preparation, are you the type of person that likes to kind of wake up the motor, so to speak, with some harder efforts? Or do you really like to relax and spend time, as much time off the bike as possible?
If it was an ideal day, I would have been here already this morning, which I wasn't. And then I would have done a really easy ride. So I'm somebody, I don't like going hard the day before. I like keeping things nice and easy. And then just taking it easy the rest of the day. So I'm not a big, like, lots of intensity before the race, although I was motivated because I saw one of your Instagram stories. So I did some intensity on the trainer on Wednesday.
Nice.
So we'll see how that goes. And I learned a lot from you guys when you talked about rest week versus a recovery week versus a taper week. Cause I've been racing for like 15 years and I never really knew the difference.
Yeah, it's super common. I think all of us are guilty of conflating at least two of those terms.
Recovery and rest.
Sure.
I always mess that up.
Right. Sure.
You guys know what I'm talking about.
How about stage racing? So like, so even though you're kind of renowned for the 24-hour solo world championship, that sort of stuff, you really do a ton of stage racing. That's kind of like your bread and butter. So you're going to Cape Epic this year. You've done Brazil Ride recently. You've done a bunch of them. You've done Mongolia Bike Challenge, like a bunch of different races. We had a famously not great experience stage racing. We probably could have been better prepared or executed better. I'm looking forward to remedying that. So some tips on stage racing. We're kind of talking about stage racing in a very compact way, in the sense of like a 24-hour race with a teammate where you're kind of switching off. What do you try to do, or do you have any tips or things that you've really learned in all your stage racing to recover between stages? Because I found that extremely hard to feel like I could recover.
Yeah, so I think I've done maybe 25 stage races or something crazy like that. Yeah, it's crazy that they just add up. But I would say for recovery, making sure you're not walking around, because a lot of times we're places where it's really neat or there's a lot going on and we just want to go see what's happening. So I try not to, I mean, it doesn't always work, but I try not to walk very much. I try to use things like elevated legs. I always invest in massage, like that really does help. And another thing, and I think a mistake people make, is they don't eat enough and they're worried like, well, I'm going to gain weight or whatever. And the stage race is not the time to be worried about caloric intake. So you should basically eat as much healthy food as you can.
Do you try to stuff yourself, or like, how do you know what's enough?
I mean, I eat till I'm full. I don't eat till I'm like you know, have a food baby. Yeah. But if you're hungry, eat, and you might need to eat extra meals more than you normally would.
Yeah, I've found that at least, so it doesn't, you don't feel like you want to eat right after a stage. You just feel kind of ugh. And then afterward, you'll get really hungry. So you need to make sure that you're eating after the stage. But then I found that like it feels like after you eat, you feel extremely full. But then you feel extremely hungry. It's like everything is just more severe, right? It's like less kind of compressed in there. It's much more severe. Is there something that you do for nutrition that you found like an easy go-to food? Because a lot of stage races, you're traveling.
Tarts.
Yeah, sure.
Is that
right? Yeah, so like traveling and you can't, for example, in Mongolia, you didn't have supermarkets that carried the stuff that you would have at a normal race. So are there anything, is there any nutrition tip that you've had to keep it consistent, or do you just go with the flow? How do you manage it?
Especially for me, I eat a plant-based diet, so I have to be really mindful of what's going on. So I always bring my own jar of almond butter because it's actually hard to find that, especially in European countries. So I always have almond butter with me because you're always going to be able to find bread, and that's my go-to race breakfast. It's just like almond butter and bread with like jam or honey. And that always works for me. So that's, I would say that. And then another funny tip is I bring my rice cooker with me. It's like a little mini rice cooker. And I have actually made my own food in hotel rooms at races because in some of the races, we are used to eating at certain times in North America, but you could be at another race or another country where they don't eat at that time. The rice cooker obviously doesn't work if you're camping in the middle of nowhere, but just bringing your own snacks is massively helpful.
How do you recon for those events? That would be like, I'm such a nerd with that sort of stuff. Before a race, I want to know everything about the course. And like when it's a mountain bike race, in my mind, I'm just like, all right, YouTube, look for, you know, point of view races, like GoPro footage of the race, right? How do you manage that when you've got something like Mongolia where it's really, there's not a whole lot to go off of? Is there a system that you go through? Maybe asking other racers, what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, number one is you have to accept that you're not going to know everything and then just be okay with that. Number two, I try and look at things as a whole, like what is the temperature going to be like for one? So for Cape Epic, for example, coming up, I've never ridden there before. I don't really know much about it, but I know that it's going to be hot. So I'm going to train for that. I'm going to ask other people what tires they run or what their experiences have been or what the terrain is like. And you can get a general feel for that because there's no way, even if you pre-rode the entire stage race, like you just wouldn't remember it. Yeah. So just getting a general feel for what the terrain and the conditions are going to be like helps you mentally kind of rest and just practice riding. Like I pretty much never get to pre-ride. So just getting used to that and saying, I'm going to be able to handle it. Now, something that I do is I always have the course profile. So some stage races gives you a sticker to put on your handlebar, but if they don't, I print it out and then I write down the kilometers or the miles of where the all climbs start and finish. That way I know, okay, we have a 10K climb to go or whatever, because if you don't know that, then it can get a little bit harder because strategically, how do you do pacing? If you know you're better on the downhill than somebody, how do you know when to make your move, etc.?
Okay, you live in Canada, and you said heat training. How do you do that?
Yeah.
It's February.
Yeah, very cold.
Yeah, well, I just signed up for the race, not even a week ago. So I started with, I was already training without a fan in my garage. I was keeping it at low 70s, and now it's up to 77 degrees in my garage with no fan. And that came about because I did a physiology assessment, and they decided not to turn the fan on. And my numbers were horrible, and I actually had to get off the bike and lay down on the ground. Like, it was crazy.
Yeah.
And they were assessing they could say what your exhale temperature was. So I learned, wow, I'm really not heat adapted. So I already started working on that. And now I've started wearing more clothes inside on the trainer, and I've started dressing warmer in my house so that my core temperature is always elevated, which may or may not happen here at this race.
Right.
And then next week I'm starting sauna training. So after my ride, I will go and I'll sit in the sauna at the gym for between 15 and 30 minutes, but I'll just be sitting there. And the hydration thing is interesting because in science, and some of the scientific studies say you need to not drink any water because it you have low blood volume, it increases the oxygen partial pressure on your kidneys, and then it increases EPO and red blood cell count. But I'm going to drink water in the sauna.
Yeah.
So I've seen I follow you on Strava, and your name's great. You have the best name in cycling, by the way. There's no one else, right, in the world?
Yeah.
Sonia Looney?
Yeah, I think not.
Yeah, so you follow her on Strava. Yeah. But on some of your train road rides, you've been turning it down. Are those your heat watt rides that you do? Do you turn it down the power because you're
Yeah.
No fan and you have extra clothes on?
Yeah, so the first couple workouts I was able to execute just fine, but I was doing like LT workouts with like a down jacket on. And then I found out that, wow, like this is, I'm not recovering from these workouts. I'm doing this every day. And I was at, I think it was one of the steps, I was at 192 watts and I was breathing like going at race pace. So my respiratory system was like really engaged. So I decided to turn things down a little bit.
Yeah. So I think that that's an important distinction to make. Yeah.
You need to do that. Like you can't do it without it.
Totally. Your ability to perform drops when it's that, when your body can't shed heat like that. Yeah. It's just, but on race day, that's a,
What you're looking for to do is there's your regular performance and then your heat performance, and you want to like make sure that the gap between the two is smaller and smaller. It's never going to be the same. Yeah. Like you're never going to perform as well as how hot is it going to be there in Cape Epic?
I don't know. Between 40 and 50 degrees Celsius, so over 100 degrees.
Oh. Yeah, so you have to be prepared for that, because that could be not only like a one where it ruins a stage, but that could be an entire race ender, and then you've gone all the way to Africa for nothing, which would be frustrating. How do you, I guess, talking about stage races, how do you manage the mindset side of things? Because you have a bad day, it's going to happen in a stage race. Like, you're going to have a bad day. Even in like a five-day stage race, it's going to happen, right? Mm-hmm. Even a three-day stage race, it can happen. How do you kind of pick yourself up off the ground, or how do you maintain perspective? Any tricks that you've had to do that?
Yeah, and I actually think that I heard Amber say this on one of your podcasts as well, is that we all think, oh, everybody feels so much better than we do, but realizing that everybody's having the same experience, it's hard for everybody. And knowing that even that feeling that you have isn't going to be permanent, because you could feel terrible one day and feel better the next day. Anything can happen. So keeping that open, growth-oriented mindset of this isn't permanent and I know it can get better. And also, if you are able to, if it's not going well, try and figure out something else you could work on. So say you just have no legs, or you just aren't having a good race. Say, well, I'm going to work on cornering this race, or I'm going to work on like meeting new people in the race, or whatever, so you can turn it into a positive experience.
What do you do like on the night laps? How do you get through those when you're like super tired? Do you have like a mantra, or you said it's all about being consistent and you were like 2 minutes consistently ahead. Mm-hmm. How do you manage that? Like, because that's where on the race that people lose a lot of time.
Yeah. If you look at night, everyone loses time at night.
Oh, well, not the fastest teams.
Right.
Or they lose less time.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And it's normal to be a little bit slower at night, but if you can be consistently the same speed at night, that's kind of what you're going for. For me, I just love people, and I love like cheering for people and yelling at people. You can tell on the ride.
Yeah.
So like at night, I turn that up a notch. So every time I see somebody, I like output a lot of energy to get it back. And it's like a transaction, because if I can interact with somebody, that wakes me up, that makes me excited, that I can cheer for them. And I just had an interaction. So I feed off of that.
I hope to see you then.
Yeah, exactly.
Give us a boost.
That could be helpful. Well, she's probably going to lap us, so yeah. I can see that happening. Yeah. we've covered quite a lot.
No, there's one thing I want to talk about is on some of these stage races, you race as a team, and on the ride, you guys were talking about it, and you were talking about strategies for picking if it's a two women or a woman and a man, how to pick your teammate. What do you do?
So for race strategy, if you're racing the mixed category, which is co-ed category, the weaker rider gets pushed physically. Like the man or the stronger rider puts their hand on the weaker rider's back and physically pushes them at different intervals of time. So an example of that technique would be if you're trying to stay in a pack and I start dropping back because I just can't put out that power, my partner just gives me a little bit of a push to push me back up into the draft. Hmm. Or if you're struggling on a climb a little bit and the crest of the climb is coming, they push you and just give you a boost over the top of the climb. So things like that, you want to pick the strongest male partner you can if you're racing co-ed. As a female team, you want to pick a female who is as equal to you as possible, both from a technical perspective and also from a fitness perspective. So it's really hard to find that soulmate partner. But for females, I mean, I have been pushed by teammate, and I have pushed female teammates as well. So sometimes it's kind of, some days you're helping your teammate and some days they're helping you.
Yeah.
But ideally you want to find somebody that's about even.
I think this whole man woman thing, I think you could just push me, Jonathan. The team
okay. Sounds push good. Me up the hills. Yeah. If only it wasn't really, single track.
It's really if you can get a rider that's so strong that they can also push you, you guys are both I guess you wouldn't go faster, but the team though, as a whole, would go faster if not.
Yeah. And you're scored off the team, right? Yeah. You're not scored off an individual time. Is there, I guess, with this sort of race, is there a mistake that you see us amateurs do that you feel like you wish you could give us a little bit of advice that like would fix that? Is there like a commonly seen mistake?
Whether it's in 24-hour?
Yeah, whether it's in 24-hour or even stage racing too. Like something that amateurs do that you go, man, I wish that I could just tell them this and it would help.
Yeah, you don't need to start so fast. Like so many people, it's incredibly hard to not start too fast. I mean, I admit that I do it sometimes as well. But if you can just hold back on that start and just realize I'm not racing for an hour, I'm racing for 8 hours or 24 hours, and just say, can I go this pace for the entire race? And if the answer is no, then you should probably back off unless you're doing something that's like a strategic move.
Yeah, so on a 4-person team, we were planning on going fast because then we can get kind of ahead of some of the riders because passing can be hard, right? Mm-hmm. Is that a good strategy for the first lap, at least for the first two people at least to go hard?
Yeah, do you think that like in this sort of a case, so for 24 hours in the Old Pueblo, it's you genuinely have a mad dash on foot. You run to your bike, the first person. Are you going to go first or Gordon in your race?
Gordon's going
to
go first.
Okay, so and then runs to the bike, gets to the bike, and then you do a first lap where you'll be, you know, fighting for a position more often than you probably will later on in the race. Is that something where you feel like it's worth that person kind of going hard, at least on that first lap, relatively to their other laps?
Yeah, as long as you don't blow up. I mean, everybody's going to be going quicker, like your lap times are going to be quicker, and especially on a four-person team, it's kind of like doing a cross-country race every 4 hours. So you are going to be going like
sounds
all out.
Lovely.
And, and it's the same for duo, too. Like you are just pinning yourself every other lap. So just making sure that you don't overcook it so that you can't, so you don't want to like burn out your throttle, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. Is there anything else that you wanted to cover? We wanted to keep this one fairly quick because we want to allow you to get back to your hotel because you're staying in Tucson, actually.
I want to know one last thing. We can end on this.
Perfect.
How did it feel to win? You talked about all the things about it, but like after you figured out that you won, what did that feel like?
To be 100% honest, I actually felt like, well, this isn't UCI, so people aren't going to take this seriously, or, oh, it's not that big of a deal. And I kept downplaying my achievement and downplaying my success, which my husband continually reminds me, like, no, like this is a legitimate thing that you've done. And you should be really proud of it. So I was excited about it for sure, but it's hard for me to celebrate my successes, and it just kind of feels like, eh, like whatever, even though it should be this like amazing thing. So something I'm actually working on is trying to figure out how to celebrate successes on and off the bike.
That's very common for successful people to feel like that.
Yes, it is, because you're kind of worried in one respect about complacency and losing your drive, right? Like in the sense that if you stop and celebrate now, and we're, you know, we have a pattern of being critical of ourselves, hopefully it's productive, not counterproductive.
They often say, I'm in a, like entrepreneur groups, and people like, you know, how many people here feel like a fraud? 80% of the people raise their hands, right?
Right.
And they're all successful people. They have that same thing. I got lucky. Like, oh, it didn't count. My, you know, it just all these things lined up, but everyone else here is really doing it. But it's not true.
It's not true.
Yeah. It's not true, right? Like,
owning your achievements, I feel like it is not only, it's an important thing on a lot of levels, and it takes a lot of, I guess, honesty. It takes a lot of vulnerability with yourself, which is really hard because it's easy for us even sometimes to be vulnerable in front of others instead of in front of ourselves. But I feel like once you can do that, you get actually a stable ground on your true reality of where you sit. And I feel like it's a really important thing, especially as a bike racer. So it's an absolutely fantastic achievement. I'm sure you've come to grips with it by now, but it's an absolutely fantastic achievement. It's pretty amazing. And just from the bottom of my heart, just as a personal thank you, you inspire so many people to ride. And it's amazing, and to enjoy riding. And I feel like that's something we could all learn, is that it's not just about like, it's not just about putting up big numbers. It's not just about winning races, that sort of stuff. But you like are very transparent in sharing your process of how you train and get better. And you inspire a ton of people. So thank you for doing that. That's awesome.
You have a happy energy.
Oh, yes, you
good.
Do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we all ride bikes because we love it, and it's easy to get mired down in the details of, oh, I'm not good enough, or I used to be faster, or so-and-so is a better technical rider than me, or so-and-so has a better bike than me. But if you just go back to the reason why you're doing it, that's what will keep you in the sport. That's how I've been racing for 15 years, which is crazy to me. Like, my God, like, I don't think I'm that old. How have I been racing that long? But really, that's what keeps you in it, is keeping the fun alive.
Yeah, absolutely. That's an awesome note to end on, I think.
Sure is.
Sonia, where can people go to find out more about you, to follow your racing and everything else like that?
My website's a great place, sonialooney.com, and I'm the most active on Instagram, which is @sonialooney and the number one.
Awesome. Cool. Well, thanks, Sonia. Appreciate it. Check out Sonia's podcast. It's awesome. Sonia Looney Show. You can listen to some really, really cool people inside and outside of the bike industry. It's really cool. So appreciate you joining us. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
Yeah. And thank you so much for having me on the show. You guys have such an awesome product and provide so much great information. And I've personally learned and benefited a lot from you guys in Trainer Road. So, and thanks to the, thanks to the listeners too.
Yeah. Thank you. Absolutely. Yeah. Fives all around.